Okay, so welcome back everyone. Today we look forward to the upcoming holiday of Purim in just a few short weeks' time, coming up relatively soon. So what I'd like to do is to, for those of us who have our youthful spirits and are considering the possibility of getting dressed up this year for Purim, or if we might have children or grandchildren who might be considering getting dressed up for Purim. We know this is a long-standing Jewish practice. And what I wanted to do is spend a little bit of time exploring where this comes from, why we do this, and hopefully along the way we'll also develop some ideas about what the Purim story is all about, what Megillat Esther has to teach us, a familiar story, but one that always gives back. I mean, there's just so much depth and richness to the whole story surrounding the holiday of Purim that I think it's always worthwhile and beneficial to circle back to it. And so I'm very much looking forward to doing that together with you. What I'd like to start off with, a source that's here only in Hebrew, I'll translate, so no worries. The first source is a source from the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is one of the great codes of Jewish law over the course of Jewish history. The author of the Shulchan Aruch is a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Joseph Caro. Rabbi Joseph Caro, living in the 16th century in the famed and holy city of Tzfat, is where he settled. His family was actually originally from Spanish descent. His family had fled around the time of the Inquisition, and eventually the family made its way to Israel and settled in that area in the northern part of Israel. Anyone here been to Tzfat?
Yes.
At any point? Okay, many Tzfat visitors, and it's a wonderful city to visit. There are many ancient, there's an ancient graveyard you can go visit. You can see the one of the coldest mikvahs in the world, which is the mikvah associated with a great Kabbalist by the name of the Arizal, who lived just a little bit later, some 30, 40 years after Rabbi Caro in the same city. And Rabbi Caro's old house actually is still present. His old synagogue can still be found there. You can actually visit. They have the blue. Anyone remember those who have been there? They have that blue is sort of the theme. It's associated with mysticism, things like that. A certain kind of color, you see it in the synagogue, you see it at his home. And so Rabbi Caro,
to do with the blue of the tablet that
it may. Tzitzit? It's possible. It may. We're actually going to refer back to that a little bit later today, as it happens. So,
who came from Israel? Yes. Her family went back like 12 generations in Tzfat. The Lag BaOmer fireworks.
Big bonfires.
Her grandfather's house, and she went back once. She said, "I have to go back." And she went back for Lag BaOmer. Nobody goes for Lag BaOmer, right? She did.
Wow, interesting.
She has such good memories.
That's the one thing I remember when my kids lived there, because they collect all year. They collect, you know, it has to be the cleanest country as far as that's concerned, because they collect everything, the kids, every twig, every stick, pile them up so they'll have them
for the Lag BaOmer bonfire. That's right.
Build fires, you know.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just thought it was interesting.
That is interesting.
That generation.
It's absolutely interesting.
There's an alley there that supposedly the Messiah is supposed to come.
Who knows?
Up this alley.
This is from the time, at this time in the 16th century, Tzfat was sort of the central axis. It was this place of mysticism in particular, not just Jewish learning in general, but in particular became the nexus of Jewish mysticism. And there were many very religious and almost reclusive personalities who were living there, who he developed into
this.
There was
a hermit there, if I recall.
Many, many very interesting personalities who lived there through that time.
Isn't it also well known for its art?
Sure, yeah, people go now and they buy all sorts of, you can go and their Havdalah candles, this gorgeous Havdalah candles that you can buy. That's right, all sorts of exotic things that you can go. It happens to be, there's also a quote unquote real Tzfat, meaning a real community of people who live there. It's a community that's relatively poor, actually. There have been efforts to try to support this community. I remember one time we went for a trip. We went to visit the old city of Tzfat and the archaeology and the history and to go and you purchase the art and the Havdalah candles and all these things, the besamim for, you know, spices for after Shabbat and all these kinds of things. And then we wanted to stop off just to buy some food. like some fruit and things like that. And so we went to a local supermarket. And it was just, it was upsetting almost to see, get a real insight as to what it means to be poor in Israel. Because there really is a poverty-stricken community, relatively speaking, that lives really just in the same area as part of the town of Tzfat. There have been recent efforts, I know, on the part of the Israeli government to give the community the support that it needs. But it was a very interesting experience to kind of see firsthand in a city that we thought of sort of for the past. Going to think about it as a city in the present as well, and that was a very it was a little bit concerning or even upsetting, but it was also an important experience for us to kind of see what need looks like among our Israeli brethren and the kinds of things that need to be done, the important contributions and work that needs to be done, things like that. So it was eye opening, but interesting. Yeah.
Yes, because it's very upsetting to think the artists are making a fortune. I mean, I was not prepared. Now I would be. But, you know, the amount of art and things that were being sold there, why weren't they compelled to give some of those taxes to the residents?
And maybe they are. I mean, I have no reason to think that they are not. I don't think... Right, I don't know.
They're artisans. So, you know, when you're dealing with artists and artist colonies, it draws in... If you remember,
it could be good for the economy. That's
exactly,
right.
Exactly. They're drawing in all these people to come there.
And that's probably going back... So, hopefully that's going back to the town. So it's not necessarily a bad thing.
So you've got all the tourists. Yeah. You've got all that. So they're making money for the town in a different way, maybe.
That's right.
But I don't think that they...
Doing anything wrong by doing that, they could be just the opposite. 100%, I agree. It was just very interesting to kind of encounter it firsthand in
my
that kind of way.
My guess is they have to rent their space, they have to rent their, I mean, they're paying money. No one's giving them, I guarantee you.
No, those are probably
exorbitant. For free.
Those are probably exorbitant rents to pay along those places.
I'm sure,
absolutely. 100%. So that's Rabbi Caro, and alongside Rabbi Caro, so he writes this great compendium of Jewish law called the Shulchan Aruch, and this is one of the greatest works. He is, as I mentioned, his family was from Spanish descent, which means that they were following the practices of the Sephardic customs. Those were the customs that they were following. Now, alongside Rabbi Caro, writing actually more or less at the same time in a different community over in Poland, in Krakow, there's another rabbi. Unbeknownst to the author of the Shulchan Aruch, unbeknownst to Rabbi Caro, there's someone by the name of Rabbi Moses Isserles. Rabbi Moses Isserles, also a great personality, living contemporaneously, is writing essentially his own version of a code of Jewish law. Now, as he lives in Poland, he's living in Krakow, so is his custom presumably Sephardic or Ashkenazic, would you say?
Ashkenazic.
Right, that's clearly Ashkenazic descent. And so he's in the middle of writing his own compendium to Jewish law, not knowing that Rabbi Caro is already many steps ahead of him, writing in the city of Tzfat, right, westward, right, unbeknownst to Rabbi Isserles. They're both writing independently. Word gets back eventually to Rabbi Isserles that he was already beaten to the punch, right, that he was already, right, that the race was about to be lost, and that as he's getting started on his compendium in the earlier stages, Rabbi Caro is about to complete his own work and his own code of Jewish law. And Rabbi Isserles, in a very moving decision, really rooted in both pragmatism but also in a sense of Jewish unity, he says, you know what? There's no reason for us to have two different codes of Jewish law. So what he does is he accepts the Rabbi Caro's work as authoritative, and instead of writing his own work, he gets the manuscripts, he receives the writings of Rabbi Caro, and he adds his own glosses. And what he says is, wherever there is a custom on the part of the Ashkenazic community that is a departure from the common practice of the Sephardic community, Rabbi Isserles writes it in. And instead of writing his own separate work, Code of Jewish Law, instead what he does is he contributes to an integrated work that essentially combines both the Sephardic and the Ashkenazic practices, and that becomes essentially the code of Jewish law, which is authoritative and highly influential until this day. So
is there ever
really
a conflict between the two?
Sure, they disagree left and right. Right? They're Jews, right? They're rabbis. I mean, what kind of question is this, right? We know.
Yes, you're right.
Yes, of course. Yes, they disagree. You're right. That's right.
The whole purpose of
right? That's right. That's right. That's right.
It wouldn't be any fun if it wasn't.
That's true.
Take it.
That's true. Right. Although they tell the opposite joke sometimes about rabbis as well. That sometimes rabbis like to tell everyone that they're right, everyone that they talk to, right? So there's a famous story about the rabbi who, unfortunately, two of his congregants, married congregants, were in a dispute. So one of the spouses comes up to the rabbi and says, explains, let's say, her side of the story and so on and so forth. And he says to the woman, you know what, you're right. So then next day the husband comes over and says, but Rabbi, so-and-so-and-so, you know, says, tells his side of the story. And the rabbi says, you're right. So there's a third person, an onlooker, you know, sees what's going on. He says, Rabbi, yesterday, so-and-so, how can they both be right? So the rabbi says, you're also right.
Right.
So, I guess we have it both ways in the Jewish tradition, right? We're always disagreeing, but everyone's always right. I don't know. That's right. So we've got all the hands taken care of. They're all covered. Anyhow, so that's the story of Rabbi Caro and Rabbi Isserlis of the Shulchan Aruch, and Rabbi Moshe Isserlis in Hebrew then becomes shortened to, becomes abbreviated as the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserlis, Reish Mem Aleph. So what I gave you here is a passage from the Shulchan Aruch. It's predominantly actually the editions of the Rama, of Rabbi Isserlis, on the Rama. I'll read some of the Hebrew and I'll translate everything for you. I'm sorry I don't have it here in the English. And he writes as follows. He says, I'm starting on the third line, those who can follow with me, and I'll translate. He says, "Umashe nahagu." He says, "That which they have the custom," says Rabbi Isserlis, "lirbosh partsufim bepurim." Right? To wear, lirbosh is to wear a partsuf. What's a partsuf? And partsuf is actually modern Hebrew as well for some sort of, essentially, a mask. Yeah, a partsuf is an appearance of a
mask or a veil.
Can be used either way. It's often used though as a reference to a mask. Anything that obscures.
Well, the man wouldn't wear a veil.
That's right. Exactly.
Although they didn't.
In Islamic lands, but yeah. Remember, Rabbi Isserlis is writing in Poland, so what? Right. So it wouldn't be common to wear it in that way in a non-Islamic land. So, or non-Arab land, I should say. So it would be. So presumably. He's referring to some sort of mask. So he talks about that. And then, I'm not going to read the whole section, but then he says, actually people have the practice, interestingly enough, to cross-dress. Believe it or not. He said, men dress like women, women dress like men. Has anyone seen this? Right? There's a prohibition in the Torah against cross-dressing.
Right.
But like most things, there's an exception one day a year. You know, what day is that?
Purim.
Right? It's Purim. Purim, all the laws get tossed out of Purim.
I don't understand why kippah, which only men wear, is feminine.
Yeah. Is feminine. What do you mean?
It's a feminine word.
Why the word itself is.
Yes.
Is yarmulke?
But kippah.
Yiddish.
That's true.
Kippah, it's feminine.
Yeah, that's
right?
True. Okay, but it's the clothing is different than the person who wears it,
right.
I guess, I suppose. Right, I don't know.
It's
for Purim. It's for Purim. That's why they did it.
I don't know. The word is feminine,
But either way, so basically what Rabbi Isserlis does here is he says also kids have the practice to grab things from one another. We never allow such things. It's terrible education. Just allow our children to grab from the person. He says, on Purim, we're a little bit more laid back about these things. The whole thing is very unusual. And among these various practices that are exceptions to the way that we usually, you know, kind of comport ourselves over the course of the year. One of the examples is that we don't dress up as ourselves. We dress up as, right, as anything, as something else. Now, it could be, right, we often have a lot of fun with it, right, and our kids, you know, dress up like their favorite superheroes, right? Now, my son very strangely decided he wanted to dress up. This is an unusual, as a prisoner this year. I don't know why. So there's a conversation ongoing in our family about this. It was very popular last year. You know, there's someone here in the community who has a side business. She sells costumes for Purim. Every year she sells them or rents them. I think she sells them, actually. She just has, and my wife went with my kids. That's how we decided to be a prisoner, because apparently that was one of the costumes.
That's an option. She's making just for Purim. I mean, you can go to
Yeah, I guess, but it's
store today.
It's, I guess, convenience. They're all there. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure. So yeah, but my wife wanted to support someone from the community, and so they went. But apparently, their house is like lined with costumes.
Oh my!
They said they walk in their whole house. It's a business, and they run it out of the house.
And Gaga, look at all
of that. Can you imagine? Well, it's a little bit. It's difficult because they can't actually use them or take them for themselves because they're being sold. But apparently, if you walk in the front door, they've got costumes lined everywhere. They walk in their house, Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, and all these superheroes. Yeah.
My daughter lives in Baltimore, in the Jewish area.
Okay.
There's a woman like that. Her whole house is all costumes.
But I would think for kids, that's a much harder thing today, because you can go to Target.
She rents them and sells them.
For Halloween, but not at
the time of the year.
No, not that's now. True.
I must tell you.
Right, that's true.
There is a story. Mm-hmm. My friend, my sister-in-law's cousin, teaches in Borough Park to children who are learning disabled.
Mm.
And it's a mixed class. There are secular kids and Jewish kids in this class.
Okay.
And once it was Halloween, and the secular kids came in costume,
mm-hmm.
and one of the Jewish kids came up to Reba and says, "Heint is poor."
Oh, that's cute.
That's cute.
It's Purim for the Gentiles.
All right.
Good. So this is Rabbi Yisrael. So he basically says that on Purim we don't follow anything we usually follow. He says that one of the various customs is to get dressed up and to wear something different. But what he does not explain is why we would do such a thing. And we usually associate Purim with revelry and unusual kinds of things and all that. And all that, right? And all that is true. That is a relevant discussion. But that's a separate discussion, right? But certainly this is a kid-friendly one as well. Let's say that, right? But he doesn't really explain why we do all these things. And in particular, why wear the masks? And is there an underlying reason for this? And the truth is that there are many different explanations that have been offered. So for example, there are those who have said, you know, it's not really originally a Jewish practice. There are those who have claimed it was actually drawn from like the equivalent of a Mardi Gras from other cultures as well. And really it's just somehow Jews like to have fun on Purim, right? It's like the equivalent of the Halloween, right? But it's ours and it's authentic and it's frankly after a long winter, you might add. Okay, so we're kind of very often itching, like we're ready to, right? It's time to kind of want to get dressed up and do something a little bit different and have some fun. And so maybe it was kind of just good, you know, Jewish version of the fun that we find elsewhere as well. Some said that. Some actually suggested that it's sort of a sign of protection from those who would seek to harm us, that around the time of Purim, of course, is representative of... Right, of...
They're in Lent.
Right.
Very frequently.
Very often, right. And it's that time, it's the time leading up to Easter.
Hold
on, just one second. Remember, but as well, just to add that, right, what happened, of course, in the Purim story is that Haman, right, sought to exterminate us. And so it's sort of a sign of, you know, the need for us to do whatever we need to do in order to get by, right? So we need to disguise ourselves. So we're going to, that's right.
She wore a mask because she hid who she was.
That's right. That's exactly, we're going to discuss exactly that in just a few moments. Okay. So 100%. Yeah, we're going to go right there.
On Purim in Muncie, all the girls came as Esther.
Of course.
All the boys came as
Mordecai.
They didn't teach them to switch, you know, the question.
No. But my daughters decided they didn't want to be princesses. So one wanted to be the sun because she brought wisdom and light.
Ah, okay.
And this is how they told me.
Yeah.
The other one wanted to be moon, because they also brought light, but in the nighttime. And my other middle daughter wanted to be a cat. So I said, why a cat?
She likes
They come
cats.
Out during the moon.
Won first prize for originality. And why? What did she explain it? She was Haman's bad luck.
Black cat.
Very good. Black cat. That's right. You could have added the color.
Okay. What was her name?
Vashti, yeah?
Because they get to wear all the jewelry. And right.
But doesn't Vashti have a not such good ending in the movie?
Yeah, she doesn't have a good ending.
We don't know exactly what happened to her, by the way. It's not clear. Was she killed? Was she, you know, was she beheaded? Or did she just deposed?
She was no.
But either way, it's nothing good.
No,
she just wasn't. That's it.
Jewelry and
she wasn't. That was that.
I don't know. Take your jewelry and go.
I see. It's like in, you know, it's like in Russia, in the USSR, behind the Iron Curtain. You were no more. Like just you no longer had an identity. That's it. Just didn't have an identity. That's all. That's it. All right. So those are some explanations. What I'd like to do is to pursue some more, and they relate to the story of the of certainly of the Megillah. But what I want to do is actually go a little bit out of order in the source sheet, and to turn your attention to a story that may be relevant, and that's on the second page at the bottom, source 8. Source 8, and here I gave you the whole story. We don't have to, and we won't be reading the entirety of the story, but I want to remind everyone of a story that might be unexpectedly connected to our discussion and to the Purim story as well. Hey guys, how are you? And I want to look at, in particular, the story from Genesis, the 27th chapter of Genesis of Bereishit. And this is the story of the trickery involving the blessings. Yeah. Right? Now, can anyone just remind us, what's the story in outline? Yeah. Anyone want to review for us? Go ahead. Yeah.
Esau, being the firstborn, he would normally get the inheritance and the blessing. And his brother, instead, his mother told him to dress up and put on hairy skin.
Say it again. What words did you say?
His mother.
No, not his mother. That's already an evil. What? His mother is different than mother-in-law. That's a different kind of thing. No, that didn't catch my attention. But dress up, right? Yes. Okay. Go ahead. Keep on going.
At any rate, he listens to his mother and he puts on because he's
the skin.
Esau's hair very hairy and he would. No, definitely not pass muster, even though he was blind. He had the touch, which it was, the fair young, younger brother. And so he usurped the blessing.
Yeah, well, say...
He said, make it fast.
That Yitzhak was old and his eyes were dim.
Well, I already said that.
Right? All agreed, 100%. Now, what I want to add to this, if we remember that according to the sort of the rabbinic tradition, whether it's literal or not, but sort of the rabbinic tradition, let's remember that Esau is the right, who eventually emerges from him. He's the ancestor ultimately of whom? According to the Jewish tradition. Okay? According to the sort of the tradition, he's associated with whom?
If you see one, you're supposed to kill it. I forget.
Not that bad. He's associated with Rome sometimes, which is one of the considered one of the ancient enemies of Israel, sort of as a prototype. I don't mean in terms of actual genealogy. But later on.
Okay. I misunderstood.
Not in a literal sense, but ultimately also at certain points because of that association actually becomes identified with nations like Amalek. You have that association at least, as well as with, right, and therefore ultimately with
Haman.
With Haman, right? Haman. Who is considered to be a descendant of the people of Amalek, who are sort of the arch enemies of the Jewish people, and so Haman is sort of repeating certain episodes in Jewish history. And so if that's true, the story of Esau and the struggle between Jacob and Esau can in certain ways prefigure the tensions and the struggle as well between the Jews on the one hand and Haman on the other, which is really interesting because what does Jacob need to do in order to capture the blessing in this story? What does he need to do? He needs to dress up, in order to essentially survive in this world. So isn't it interesting, because we mentioned earlier this notion that in order to sometimes survive as Jews, we need to dress up. right? And so is it possible that as part of that remembrance, we're actually going all the way back? I've seen this suggested. We're all going all the way back to this earlier story about Jacob, right? And Esau, they're trying to grapple for the blessing and the need for Jacob to dress up as part of it. Is it possible that when we wear the masks, we're sort of hearkening all the way back to that story, right, in Genesis, which would be a really interesting kind of thought. Now, there's one point as well, though. Jacob changes something, but he does not change something else. You know, he changes his clothing. That's true. But what does he not change? His voice, right? What is, right?
Oh, right.
Right?
What is, you have
what does his father say? What does Yitzchak or Isaac say?
Something of the right? Saw, but the right? Voice of...
He says, right? Yeah. So he says, right? Let's find it inside, actually. If you go to page 3, where Yitzchak says... He says, let's start with 20 in the English. 20, toward the bottom of page 3, about 6 lines up from the bottom.
Yeah.
20. And Isaac said unto his son, how is it that thou hast found so quickly my son? Right? How did you get the food so quickly?
Mm-hmm.
We know, of course, that Rebecca, right, had cooked rather than having him go out to the field. And he said, because the Lord thy God sent me good speed. Okay. And Isaac said unto Jacob, come near, I pray thee, that I may feel thee, my son, whether thou be my very son Esau or not. 22. And Jacob went near unto Isaac his father, and he felt him and said, right, so this is now Yitzchak the father declaring with regard to his son Yaakov, the voice is the voice of Jacob, right? But the hands are the hands of Esau, of Esav, right? And he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy as his brother Esau's hands, and so he blessed him, etc. Okay? So what happens? So the hands may be the hands, the hairy hands, right, of his brother. Right? But what about the voice?
The voice he didn't disguise. He just spoke in his own voice.
That's right. And interestingly enough as well, in the rabbinic tradition, it's not just that the voice, in other words, the inflection, the tone with which he spoke was immediately recognizable or identifiable. It was more than that. It was the language that Jacob had invoked. Because what did he say? What word did he use when he referred to his success out in the field?
Oh, he credited God.
That's right. Exactly, right? In verse 20, he credited God, right? It says back in verse 20, right? In Pasuk Chath. And he said, because the Lord thy God sent me good speed. So according to Rashi, one of the great commentators drawing from the rabbis, it's not just that the voice sounded like that of Esau. Right? It could be that he could have maybe made it up that up as well. He could have gotten some voice lesson training. By the way, that's a practice on Purim as well. Sometimes people will put on other personas as part of these masks and play out. This is fun. Students sometimes act out their rabbis. I've had that happen to me. It happened. The kids did a great sketch of me.
You know they're observant.
What? Yes, I do. Yeah. Well, I take it as a compliment. If they leave you out of the Purim spiel, that means you're not relevant. But if they really get you good, that means you've left an impression. So I took it in good stride. But it wasn't. But in any. But here it's not just right. So it's interesting. In other words. So what I want to say is that I think this is almost symbolic or representative of the Jewish journey in exile, which that's exactly what Purim is all about. Because remember, as we're going to get to now, right, wasn't that the entire story? How do we get by in exile? Right, how do we not get ourselves in trouble? How do we escape unnecessary or counterproductive scrutiny and attention? And yet at the same time, how do we stay true to our own voices? How do we dress?
The Muranos, I mean, there's a perfect mask that they put, not that it helped in the end, but nevertheless,
right,
they put on the clothing, everything, you know, and behavior, and try
it's
to maintain
not,
right,
underneath their Jewish.
It's not
that's
only
right.
The
so
voice that James, it's the words that he used.
The content.
Right. The content. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important as well. That's right. So how do we outwardly appear a certain way, but not only inwardly, but even in our behaviors, really continue our Jewish practices and our traditions, mm-hmm, and strike that healthy balance. And that's really very much the story of what Purim is all about. It's that struggle of Jews who live in exile and struggle with these kinds of questions, right? Not just in America, or not as much in America as we know in other parts of the world, Western Europe, etc. right? But these are the questions, right? Not wearing a kippah in public and all these kinds of things.
I remember these when are, but staying true. That was quite a big issue about 25 years ago about wearing the kippah. So I remember.
But here in America?
Yeah. Yeah.
What?
Whether the guys should wear it when they went to work.
Oh,
and it was a whole big thing.
Yeah.
Especially I had a cousin who was very important in the aerospace.
Mm-hmm.
And he and there was a few others who were religious young men.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to wrestle with this.
Yeah.
In the end, they ended up wearing them, and they also had themselves a private thing and everything.
You know, having come from an area where there were not a lot of Jews, I grew up in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
When my kids went to the seminary once, there was a high school.
Mm-hmm.
And we dropped them off in New York. And I was impressed with the kids with jeans, dressed like any other kid, but with a kippah in the streets. And this is near Harlem and near, you know, not in a great neighborhood, a Jewish neighborhood necessarily.
Right.
And I was impressed with the fact that in this country you could do this.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
As my grandfather's only in America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
But
not always not perfect.
No,
it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than we've ever done in so many places that we've been.
Never lived anywhere else.
That's right.
So I know.
That's very different.
Came out with a friend who looked later than the other kids.
Yeah.
His friend was the fastest runner that was set on by a bunch of non-Jewish boys. The fastest runner went to my chubby brother, got beaten up and he tore off his bleachers, and the cop turned his back and left.
Just like a. Right.
Exactly. So it wasn't a mistake.
Yeah.
Oh, look, it's even today. It's not perfect. It's just better than other places.
Absolutely.
I love George's cousin when he went for a job up in Massachusetts, and on a paper that he had to write and fill in, they wrote church preference. So he wrote Gothic. Of course he didn't get the job.
But we do live in a world
where it's not allowed to ask.
You can't ask the question to begin with. Yeah, that's no.
Gothic is in, right?
Yeah.
Well, when I was working, there was no one to cover Christmas. So I said, put it in the paper that there has to be someone that will work on Christmas. There was myself, another Orthodox Jewish woman, and an Indian guy. Hmm. And that's all there was, and the rest had to work on Christmas, and they were pissed.
I always worked on Christmas. It was
just,
Interesting.
You want good care? Get sick on Christmas. All the Jewish doctors.
When I was teaching at school, they docked my pay when I took off for Rosh Hashanah.
Everybody.
Yeah, they did.
They didn't close the schools, and it wasn't recognized. And I was furious because they were always closed for Christmas and Easter.
We have come a long way.
Yeah.
In many places. We really have.
So many teachers and principals were Jewish that they did it. They didn't do it out of
kindness.
But only in these cities, if you lived in Virginia, they did
not. No,
it was very
that was many years ago.
The Archdiocese took over our hospital. And they came to me and they wanted me to be the head of, I won't say where, okay? And they had a big meeting of all the big shots, and they called me in and they said, you realize you'll have to work on Saturdays. I said, I don't work on Saturday. Well, when you come to work for us, you will have to work on Saturdays. I said I was willing to work on Sunday and knew darn well no pathologist works on Sundays. I said, I'm willing to work on Sundays. I said, but if you insist that I work on Saturday, you will have a spread in the Inquirer and all the local newspapers that you are telling me that I have to work on my Sabbath. I said, I don't think that will fly. And I sat there, everyone was quiet, and no one said anything.
Did you get the job?
Oh, yeah.
After that? But they had, otherwise,
it was a woman that became in charge of the hospital, and she wanted to show how strong she was. She also showed how stupid she was.
Wow.
Well, I'm proud that you spoke up.
Yeah, don't mess. That's what I learned.
Sometimes you don't speak up, and you're sad for that.
It's important. Know, that's
not but we do live.
Yeah, I wasn't speaking up it's for me. I was speaking up for Jews.
It's perfect.
Nothing is not perfect.
No, I'm saying.
Of course, it's not perfect, but it's that's right.
Okay. Orthodox Jews.
All right. So now to continue. So we've gone all the way back to Genesis, and we've seen that maybe the practice of getting dressed up has roots all the way back in Genesis, but certainly the idea of wearing costumes and hiding our identity and then revealing our identity is certainly something that is manifest in the Purim story itself. I wanted to review that, except it's not just our story, interestingly enough, it's others' stories as well. In other words, there are other characters in addition to the Jewish characters in the Purim story that, at least according to the tradition, are getting dressed up. So I wanted to look at that together with you and to think that through together. So the first example I don't even have here on the sheet, although you can certainly come back to page one where we'll pick up when we do see the sources. And the first one is really before even anything that appears in the text. But let's remind ourselves what happens in the first chapter of the story.
What, Genesis?
No, now I'm in
you're
Esther.
You're back to Esther.
I'm in Esther, yeah.
She's spoken to by Mordecai.
The first chapter, the first scene. Forget Esther and Mordecai for a second. What happens?
Vashti.
Right, Achashverosh does what?
Oh, he summons her.
Okay, he summons her in the context of throwing what?
An orgy.
It throws, yeah, a big party. Okay. I was just going to say a party, but okay. All right.
That's what it boiled down to with all the drinking they did.
That's pretty much it. And so he invites everyone to come and the whole big scene and everything. Now, what's interesting is that a couple of things. Number one, right, he displays remarkable wealth. It's over the top, right? The kinds of cloth and fabric, food, etc., that he displays at this party is absolutely extraordinary. And it's, by the way, it's not 100% clear whether or not this is truly representative of his real wealth. In other words, was he really so wealthy, right? Sometimes the wealthy king wants to put everything out there. But sometimes you have a king who's reasonably well off, but isn't necessarily the most important, most accomplished, wealthiest person, emperor, as it were, on the earth, but wants to kind of make the statements that, I'm one of them, right? And I'm, if you want to know who's, right, the rich and famous, who should be on top of that list, right? You're looking at him right now, right? So it's possible that Achashverosh really was that wealthy. We don't have the historical information to know, but you kind of get the sense sometimes that this foolish king was kind of trying a little bit too hard, perhaps, to make a spectacle, to kind of demonstrate just how well off he really was. In which case, which is a real issue. I mean, it's an issue because it creates communal. That's right. And also it creates a lot of communal pressure sometimes that's unhealthy. Yes, everyone's trying to be like the Joneses, and it's really not good for the Joneses or any of us.
Maybe
so that's
the
a real
what the
you got. That's right. You have to remake the parable. Anyhow, so that's number one. So is he being, again, this is not just his physical clothing, but is that what she's demonstrating? Is it real or is it perhaps putting on a show, right? Is a little bit of a farce and try to create a certain kind of image, right? And to project that, whereas is it really true? We're not really so sure, number one. Number two, in the rabbinic tradition as well, at least, he wears a particular set of clothing at one of the parties. According to the rabbis, he actually inherits, because according to the rabbis, Vashti, right? So that original wife, Vashti, is actually the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, according to the according to the Midrash.
We always pronounce right? it Nebuchadnezzar.
That's which right, is, but I couldn't.
Which
what?
Is correct?
What? Which is correct? One is the original Hebrew in the Bible, and the other one is the English translation of the Bible. But it would be literally Nebuchadnezzar would be the literal reading of the biblical Hebrew. I don't know what his the Babylonian would have rendered, but I have to brush up on my Babylonian. Once I do, I'll let you know. So he, according to the rabbinic tradition, Vashti is the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, the one who had destroyed the first temple and had also sacked the temple of, among other things, its riches, its various vessels, as well as clothing that would have belonged to the priests. And according to this tradition, through Vashti, Ahasuerus actually inherits the clothing of the high priest. And he brings these out as a show of victory and a show of accomplishment and, you know, sort of, you know, who he is and what the kinds of things that he wears. He walks out at the party in the clothing of the high priest. All, in other words, all dressed.
I mean, this is written that
all dressed up. This is a rabbinic tradition.
Oh, okay.
But I believe that it's an overlay on what does. I think it's not the simple reading of the text at all. But I think what it is a rabbinic overlay that's consistent with one of the basic messages of the text, which is this notion that essentially what Ahasuerus is trying to do is to put on a show and trying to present himself and represent himself in a way that may not really be accurate. But that's exactly what he's trying
that
to
he
do.
More
so,
isn't that what,
really
isn't that what
was.
All kings and rulers?
That's right.
You know, when Jimmy Carter came in and had to wear a sweater, and everybody was like, "Oh my God, he's the president, and he's sitting there in a sweater."
That's right.
Have this persona that it's all
that's
part
true.
Of the dress and how you look.
That's true, but it's also possible to be regal without kind of feeling the need to throw 127, or 187 days of parties, and to walk out in the high priest clothing. I mean, there is, on the one hand, there are clothing, that's right, and there's a healthy balance, and there's sort of a sign of sometimes of insecurity, of trying to put on a persona that really is not really who you are. That's kind of, right, and we've all seen that. We can tell that from a mile away when someone that we know or someone that we see is doing something that is so clearly fake just to get attention or to feel a sense, to feel good about themselves, and it's and you know, that's not where one derives a sense of self-worth. It needs to be authentic.
In preparation to show him as a vulnerable person that Haman could take advantage of.
Oh, cool. Clearly. I mean, that it's clear that Haman sees an in and sees opportunities to, you know, he's clearly the one who's pulling the string. Oh, God is. But at least Haman believes that he is. There's no question about that. Yeah. I think so.
It was his wife, Vashti, who said this. Supposedly the daughter of
Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, according to this tradition, yeah.
It also shows Haman that he's vulnerable.
Won't he be a descendant of the
former
king?
Well, it's actually part of this whole discussion is that it's not clear that Ahasuerus had real yichus.
Yeah.
It's not clear. I mean regal yichus, monarchical yichus. And it seems that he may have been a layman who was married to the daughter of such an outstanding personality. So that may be part of it, is that here he is, this person who is a slave off the street, who somehow managed, the pauper to riches story, and he managed, right? That's right. Something like that, and has to then establish himself or make a name for himself, but kind of tries just a little bit too hard as part of that process. In fact, the deposing of Vashti might be part of this. In other words, right, you think I'm held to that, right? My only stature comes from being connected to, right, this outstanding line of personalities. Right? I can depose her and I can still be the king. So that could be part of the whole discussion here. So Ahasuerus clearly is dressing up taking on personas that are not authentic necessarily. And that's one piece of the story. But of course, as was mentioned, right, Esther does as well. Right? Esther hides her identity. It's very hard to miss the connection between putting on a mask, hiding our own identity, and what Esther did in the story, as was mentioned earlier as well. So for example, you have in source 2, right, in the second chapter, in verse 10, right, Esther had not known her had not made known her people nor her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not tell it, right? So already when she's taken away among all the other women who are stepping forward in this contest, right, Esther, right, is hush-hush. She's quiet about her lineage. No one knows that she's Jewish. Still, in source 3, right, later on that same chapter, in verse 20, Esther had not yet made known her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandments of Mordecai, like as she was when she was brought up with him. She does not say anything. She does not give away her lineage. And so there's this intentional decision not to tell, presumably because, right, it would have potentially negative consequences for her, right? She certainly could be disqualified from this opportunity, right? That's right, okay? And who knows what other consequences there could be. Now, all that is fine and good until, of course, Haman says, sorry, just want to move it ahead a little bit, if that's okay?
I think we're a little bit ahead of ourselves. Shouldn't we establish who Mordecai is in the king, you know, in this story, and his where he gets his power, he's, you know.
Mordecai.
Yeah, Mordecai.
Right.
His position in the realm.
If you just read the Megillah itself, you don't see anything other than the fact, the relationship with Esther. That's really all we know from the text. All we have in the text. Now, there are traditions that say he was an outstanding scholar, that he knew 70 languages, and that's how he informed the king about this plot of this assassination plot. And all the, you have that as well. It's not in the text of the Megillah itself, which is interesting enough. But we have that. I mean, it's clear that he rises to power by the end of the story, which we'll see. What his stature was prior is a little bit murky beyond his relationship with Esther in terms of just the text itself, despite some of those traditions. So it's not 100% clear, but 100%, that's certainly true. Now, Esther's hiding her identity, but of course we know the story. We know that that perforce needs to change, right? And we see that happening, interestingly enough, with clothing that's being worn, except this time in an authentic kind of way, right? Because we had Ahasuerus wearing fake clothing. Haman has his power grab and wears what? He's got, in particular, the ring that the king puts on his finger, and Haman now quickly rising to the second in command, etc. And Mordecai, by contrast, hears about this decree against the Jews, and what does he do? So in chapter 4, in source 4 here as well, so he puts on clothing of mourning. Right? Puts on clothing of mourning. So again, they see how the clothing, the different kinds of dressing up, are so central to moving ahead the whole plot. Right? And that's what you have. Now, when Mordecai knew all that was done, Mordecai rent his clothes, put on sackcloth with ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and cried with a loud and bitter cry. Right? So he's wearing clothing, this time authentically, in the sense that, right, he really is in a process of mourning. Right, of mourning, and it's really truly consistent with his state of mind and his grave concerns for the people. Now, here's what becomes interesting, is that then, by contrast, in order for Esther to accomplish what she needs to do, what does she do?
She first puts
on royal clothing, and that you have in source 5, the beginning of chapter 5. Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court of the king's house over against the king's house, and the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house over against the entrance of the house. So Esther now is going to don her royal clothing, and what does she do? After she does that,
invites the king to
She makes that request, right? She's so nervous about it. right? 30 days I haven't been called to the king, she says to Mordecai. I'm not sure I'm going to be successful, but ultimately she does. She puts in, right? She puts starts to put in her request. So fascinating. Here you have, again, dressing up clothing is, right? But here it's authentic. So originally Esther hides her identity. She revealed her identity yet as a Jew?
No.
Not yet. But she's taken some steps. Mordecai has taken a step in terms of putting on sackcloth, leading his people in prayer in an authentic way. Esther puts on her clothing of royalty, at least, although she has not yet revealed her actual identity. And I didn't give it to you here, right? But eventually, what does she do? Right? She invites the king and Haman to the first party and then to a second party again, right? Correct? To a banquet. And what does she do? Right, eventually she reveals her identity. Right, and that's really very much the crux of the story, the turning point of the story. Right, so that's clearly essential to everything that's happening. Not only does Esther wear royalty, right, but who else gets to wear royalty? Right, Haman's royal clothing are transfigured onto Mordecai, and that you have in source number 6 here. Haman said unto the king, right, remember, what's the story? What happens? Right, Haman says to, right, the king turns to Haman's trusted advisor and says, right? What should I do? Right? What should I do for the person, right, whom I wish to offer glory to? So what does Haman, of course, think to himself?
Yeah.
It's coming to me. Right? So he recommends this whole elaborate procession. And of course, the king turns it against him and says, that's what you should do. Right, for Mordecai. If you look at source 10, right, then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel. Excuse me, source 6, I'm sorry. Source 6, verse 10, I apologize. Yeah. Then the king said to Haman, make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou said, and do even so to
Mordecai the Jew
that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. So isn't it fascinating that the clothing of royalty, right, which Haman had been donning, now, right? Right, Esther wears them, but now in particular being, right, are going onto Mordecai. Remember, who is wearing the priest's clothing earlier as well? Achashverosh. Achashverosh clearly has been, right, he's not been deposed or anything like that, but clearly he's been he's been exposed, I think it's fair to say, as someone who's not really in charge. He may be throwing these elaborate parties and trying to project himself a certain way, but it's really obvious from the get-go and becomes more and more obvious that really it's Haman who's drawing, right, who's making the decisions. It's Esther who then, right, in turn, right, gets, right, wrests control from Haman. But they're all, right, they're all trying to figure out who's going to be the one who's really pulling the strings. But we know, and ultimately, right, we believe that it's God who's pulling the strings in the largest sense of the term. But even the immediate characters and protagonists in the story itself, right, we see that, right, it's clearly clear that Achashverosh is, right, for, right, to use a, right, what book would this represent? Children's book? What children's book could represent Achashverosh? Well, about an emperor?
The emperor wears the
clothes. Okay. Right, okay. That's Achashverosh. That's it. Right? That's all you need to know. And it works perfect. Right? That's right. And that's it. He's just, right, he's all dressed up. And everyone's treating him with such regality and such honor and such respect. But really, they're just rolling their eyes. And they all know that, they all really know the truth. So this whole question of clothing and being able to wear clothing is, I think, really what this is all about. But I want to add one other thing, which is, who mentioned Tchelet earlier?
Did we mention, I did.
What?
I did.
Right? Tchelet, right? So it's interesting to mention that. Why is that so interesting? So earlier we talked about the party that Achashverosh throws, right? Mm-hmm. One of the materials or colors that's mentioned, the fabric colors that's mentioned, is this royal blue of this Tchelet. Now, the word royal is very interesting, because the Tchelet color, if we look in the Bible, was used by the Jews in a few instances. It was used on the fringes of the tzitzit, but it was used in other cases as well. The clothing of the high priest, and the priests, interestingly enough, had that color of Tchelet. The tabernacle in the desert was adorned as well with that same color, as well as some of the vessels that were used in the construction of the tabernacle as well. In fact, there's a classic explanation that the tchilet really is a royal color, not just sort
so
of we call it
the Israeli flag with the blue and the white.
I think I don't know if that was the intention, but I think that worked nicely.
The spelling of that color.
Of that color, the tchilet. We don't know for sure. It's actually, it could be a sky blue. It could be a darker blue than that. It's actually, it's not, there's some, yeah, there's
it's
a, some
well,
like shade
deepish,
toward green.
It's a deepish blue.
I wear them, and I'll show you the color that I assume, which is a deeper royal blue, not super dark. You can start to see it over here. Okay, it's not all that dark, but
it's a little lighter.
Yeah, it's not a dark blue, but there are different opinions.
I find it ironic that something that is used for such a revered holy item, the tali, it comes from a treif mollusk.
It comes from a snail. That's interesting, but and that's a beautiful lesson in that as well, right?
What comes from a snail.
The tchilet, the color, the dye. That's right.
That's where you
But there's like this elevation, right? It's an opportunity for elevation, I guess, is the message. But I think one of the interesting things that I wanted to add to all this is that it's not just clothing, but it's in particular clothing of royalty, right? That it's Ahasuerus who's wearing the high priest's clothing. It's Haman who's wearing. But in fact, ultimately, the ones who emerge are Esther and clearly, in particular, it's Mordechai, right? And the tchelet of the high priests, right? Because remember, the destruction of the temple stands in the backdrop of a lot of the story. We're in exile in Shushan. We're not in Jerusalem. The capital for the Jews is now a different city. It's Shushan instead of Yerushalayim. And so, essentially, what I think is happening here is that there's a reminder in the story of the Megillah. And that's part of the dressing up. That it's not just that we're wearing fun outfits, but there's a sense of, right, dressing up for who we are. I know it doesn't really work when you just do like the, you know, dress up like a superhero or in the cute sense, but like the superhero, I think, is not a bad kind of metaphor here, which is it's a reminder, yes, number one, that in order to get by in exile, you need to sometimes dress up. And that's, I think, one part of it, right? But at the same time, we need to stay authentic to our traditions. And that's the representation of the story of Jacob and Esau that we saw earlier. But I think there's an additional piece as well, which is that there's a sense of dressing up, but in a healthy sense, not like Ahasuerus, who was trying to put on a persona that was not authentic. But I mean in the truest sense of the term, as people who are servants of God, who have a unique relationship with Him, and really have a sense of royalty. So I think part of what Ahasuerus teaches us, and the inversion of Ahasuerus into the personalities of Esther and Mordechai, is that sense of Jewish royalty, is a sense of Jewish pride, the sense of dressing up in a way that really represents how proud we are of our traditions, of our ability, despite the fact that we've been chased around the globe and we have to sometimes dress up to get away, but also to dress up in a positive sense as well. So I think that this idea of dressing up really represents a lot of these beautiful messages about what it means to live as a Jew. Sometimes the need to hide, but to always speak with our own voice, with the voice of God, and to dress up with a sense of pride in who we are, because only when we dress up with pride as Jewish royalty that we can really succeed in passing on those messages to future generations as well.
What is appropriate when you're buried?
Mm-hmm. Because there we wear very simple clothing.
Yes,
that's right.
Backwards.
That's right. And we wear, that's interesting.
The same as everybody.
Shrouds, right.
And death, we're the same as everybody.
That's, yeah. And that's a great point.
When
it's a tension, right?
Oh,
it's a tension because on the one hand, we believe that we are the simplest of beings
that's
and yet we have such potential. But I think you're right. I think death is sort of the ultimate equalizer. It's a reminder of our limitations as well. But you're right, there's a tension then. That's true.
I have a question. And it has to do with, of course, the way I am. But now that you put in that extra piece of that poverty, being that she was actually a princess who became to be,
it's a tradition, right?
She, okay, for women, not Jewish women, to me, if the story as I always heard it is true, she becomes my hero because, and also has to do with dressing. What is she asked to do? She is asked to undress. She's asked to go in there and dance.
And she refuses.
So she has to take off her royal, let's say, clothing, as you say, and show a side that she doesn't want to be.
Right.
By the loss of clothing. In other words, if she takes off her...
So it's a sign of dignity. That's right.
It's sort of the reverse. So she becomes, in my mind, a hero because...
I think that's
not a Jewish hero, but a hero for women because she refuses which also shows that the king doesn't have much power. He can't even make his wife dance.
That's right.
Right? So.
But and then he sends his letter that every man is the master of his own home. Everyone's exactly. Imagine they're rolling their eyes. Like, you're not the master of your own house, right. And you're the king, and you expect,
you know. So to my mind, she's a good
100. That fits in very nicely. So I guess the another symbolism there is that clothing is a sign of dignity and self-respect. And he tries to turn her into an object.
She's willing to give
and
up
she says, I'm not an object,
everything.
I'm a subject. I'll give it all up to stand up for my dignity and to, frankly, keep my clothing on. 100%. That's beautiful as well. I like that very much. I think it fits in nicely.
I don't understand
yes.
Very well how Mordecai dresses in a